In the Moment on SDPB is supported by the South Dakota Humanities Council, presenting the South Dakota Festival of Books, September 20th through 22nd in Brookings.
A Rapid City company has changed the way many kids learn how to ride bikes. From SDPB, it's Monday, August 19th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, we get to know a South Dakota family whose daughter rides an adaptive Strider bike. We'll talk about the power of a business idea based in the Black Hills. If you have considered applying to be a Bush Fellow, take note, there are more opportunities than ever before to step into the program. We'll learn about increased funding after the news. We'll also learn about soil mapping research in South Dakota that could change ag practices around the globe. Plus, South Dakota artist Claire Lockhart returns with news of an international platform for her art and artistry. That's coming later in the hour. We're broadcasting live today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the Moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. The Bush Fellowship lifts up local leaders in the region to empower them to do more good in their community, and three of the 2024 fellows are South Dakotans. You may have heard our conversations with Rapid City's Lily Mendoza and David O'Hara of Sioux Falls on the show earlier this summer. Well, now we are going to speak directly with the Bush Foundation about some changes to the 2025 application process. If you have been thinking about this, take note, because they are significant changes that open the door even wider for more Bush Fellows from our region. Adora Land is a grant-making director at the Bush Foundation, and she's joining us now via Zoom. Adora Land, welcome. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here with you today.
These are exciting changes. And as a 2022 fellow, I remember being in the room when people who are fellows were telling the Bush Foundation leadership, hey, you might want to think about this, or this is what we're noticing in our fellowship. So tell me a little bit about getting feedback from current and former fellows and taking that into consideration as you look at how the program might need to change.
Yeah, the Bush Fellowship is really growing across the region. And when we started to look at what the grant amount was and started having those conversations, we realized that what you could do with $100,000 before doesn't go as far as it does today. And so we really took into account how our fellows could get the best out of their fellowship by increasing the grant. So as you know, the grant has increased to $150,000. And then we also started to think about access. So as it's growing, as we're getting more applications, we want to be able to impact the greatest number of leaders as possible. And so we started to look at how many fellows we could add. And we have transitioned to 30 fellows instead of 24.
And then there's a big third change, because every time I do these interviews, I talk to people about how intense the application process is and how that can be a really good thing because it helps clarify what you want to do and you have people kind of mentoring you through that. And you have simplified the application process. It had some strengths before, but it had some struggles for people. Tell me why you thought about simplifying the application process and what it has changed to.
Yeah, I mean, as you mentioned, it has been a great process where people had the opportunity to reflect, but also could be a confusing process as well. So as you are going throughout the application process, it's long, you are now shifting and changing. And so what we're seeing in the beginning may not be where you are in the end, which is great as well. But we wanted to make sure that as we are looking at fellows, we want to look at fellows who are already thinking about their leadership journey and really have a great plan. So this year, we're going to do one application process with five questions. So once you submit one time, you don't have to submit again. And we're really centering on opportunities on how we can help uplift fellows in developing their plans so that they are coming in strong with the plan of what they will do if they become a Bush Fellow.
All right. So now let's bring in some people who maybe their ears are a little bit perked up because they hear that this might be something for them when before, you know, they weren't quite sure. Who do you want to imply? What are you looking for? What kind of leaders are you looking for? Where at in their journey are they? Give us the pitch. Yeah.
Yeah. So leadership for us isn't about a role or a title, but we really know that there are all sorts of leaders who are leading and driving big change within our region, which is in Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and the 23 Native Nations within that geography. And so it's really important for us to understand who the fellows are, how are they unique to the work that is happening. And you could really be at any stage within your leadership journey, as well as come from any sector. So the business sector, government, nonprofit, we're not limited. But we are looking for fellows who are really committed to leading equitable change and creating large scale change, who have influence within their communities with a proven track record of making good change happen, as well as people who are experienced problem solvers and able to get results.
One of the things that I heard again and again was think bigger until the point where my brain, I was like, oh my gosh, if anyone tells me to think bigger, my brain's going to break. But it has stuck with me because sometimes, and a lot of people in my cohort, you know, maybe they've never been told that before. Talk a little bit about your work with people and helping open the doors of possibility for them, which then turns into really transformative work in their communities.
Yeah, when we talk about the Bush Fellowship, we're always thinking about what would you do with the fellowship that would not be possible if you didn't have the fellowship? So as you are thinking big about what you can do, it may not be just going to pursue a degree. It may be pursuing a degree. It may be pursuing some traditional learning, but also thinking about all of the ways that you can learn outside of the traditional sense of learning. Mm-hmm. So when you are thinking about your vision for change, what feels like this only could happen 20 years down the line. But if I do this today, I can help my community get there 20 years down the line. So we always are asking people to really think big about the change that they want to make within themselves, but also the change that they want to make within the community.
Yeah. What brought you to this organization? What made you want to work for the Bush Foundation?
I have been doing leadership development work even prior to coming to the Bush Foundation, and it really felt like a great opportunity to get to know leaders throughout the region, as well as supporting them and helping them thrive. So thinking about what sustainability and leadership looks like, not only learning from the leaders that are Bush Fellows, but them having the opportunity to learn from me and the expertise that I also bring.
Let's talk a little bit about how to get started, because the applications are going to open up in September. But there are some resources online where you can start planning and thinking about what you want to do. Help us figure out the best way to enter into this space and find out whether, because the hardest question I had to answer, Adora, when I applied was, why is this the right time? And I really had to think about, is this the right time? And I didn't apply for several years because I was like, it's not the right time yet. It's not the right time. And then it was. So that's my advice to people who often ask me whether they should apply. I ask them that question, like, why now? What is the thing that makes sense to you now? What would you add to that, you know, for people who are listening to consider, and how do they take those first steps?
I love that advice. I just want to say that. Like, that is one of the key advice points that I give as well when people ask me. But one thing that I love is that although the applications open September 17th, if you go to our website, all of the information that you need to know about the Bush Fellowship is on our website, including the 5 questions that we ask throughout the application process and the selection criteria. And so if you are someone who is considering applying, you can go to the website today and look at what those questions are and start to really think about how you would answer those questions. Start to reflect on your leadership journey. Start to think about where you want to go and how you want to have impacting your community. So it's not necessarily just having to write out the application now, but it gives you an opportunity to start thinking, start having some conversations with people around you about how they see your leadership as well. So that can inform how you move forward in your application process.
Yeah, super helpful to ask other people how they see you as a leader. That's another great piece of advice that I love as well. Also, when you go to that website, I think they're all still available, but you can access the fellows of the past, their learning logs and their reflections, so you can follow what people have done and hear those stories too, which also can be really insightful, I thought.
Yes, you can. And I think it can also help you develop your plan, right? Yeah. You can see how other people are thinking big, and maybe you haven't thought about doing that, but after reading it, you're like, I want to do this now with my fellowship.
Wow. Just a game changer for so many communities and for people and for me. So Adora Land, thank you so much, Grant Making Director at the Bush Foundation, for giving us this update. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. I'm excited for this upcoming year, and I look forward to you all applying for the Bush Fellowship this year.
Let's go, South Dakota. Ag producers who need to know vital information about their farmland can look to the skies. South Dakota researchers are using satellite data to more accurately map soil moisture. The NASA-funded project is seeking to create new algorithms that use AI to create widespread maps. Han Kui Jong is an assistant professor at South Dakota State University. He is the primary science investigator on the project and is joining us now from SDPB's Janine Basinger studio at SDSU in Brookings. Professor Zhang, welcome. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me. Thank you.
All right. Tell us about why soil moisture data matters.
We live in we're now in South Dakota, which is an agriculture state. So soil moisture is important to make decisions like irrigation, and also important for crop yield. So in particular nowadays, we have in the Great Plains, we have more than 100 years of irrigation. Now the water, groundwater has depletion. So doing this precision irrigation is really important, and soil moisture measurement is critical information to make such decisions. So,
what are the challenges? Why is it so hard to get the data?
So soil moisture, we can do field measurement, but that's too labor intensive. Right now, we have satellite data to measure this large area, especially continuous soil moisture. But that's satellite data also has challenges. Is the satellite signal is not often always from soil moisture, the crop canopy, and soil and topography. This all also contribute to satellite signals. So how to separate this signal from soil moisture signal to derive soil moisture is quite a challenge. It's a research field for more than four decades.
Yeah. So how will your research project work? What help us understand what your research question is, for example?
Yeah, so this is in the context of NASA. We launch a new satellite called NISAR, N-I-S-A-R. So this is in collaboration between NASA and the Indian Space Agency. So this NISAR data is unique because it has very high spatial resolution, which can see clearly the field, each individual field is 10 meter spatial resolution. Our algorithm is based on AI. It's different from a traditional NASA algorithm. They based on a physical model. They call it radiative transfer models. We didn't use this approach because, to be honest, no one can compete with NASA on this their algorithm. Yeah. So instead, we use this data-driven AI method. Also, because there are currently a lot of ground-based measurements available, like in U.S., we have more than we have around 2,000 sites. They call to hourly to measure soil moisture hourly. That data is publicly available. So this is a very valuable data source for train our AI model. So this is the core of the project. Yeah.
So, but they don't talk to each other. So is that part of the challenge, is getting the data to from different platforms to sort of consolidate?
Yes, that's part of the challenge, to consolidate the data from the satellite and from ground measurement, and also to develop the right AI models. So there's many different AI models available. Like we may use ChatGPT every day. So our model is underlying model is the same model used for ChatGPT. It's called transformer model.
Okay.
But we still need to reconstruct some parameters, some structures to get it fit to soil moisture mapping.
Yeah. What is the time frame for this kind of research? Sometimes I think, you know, research, we need to be patient, but then in the world of AI, sometimes things happen way faster than I thought they would be able to happen. When you look at time frame, what are the parameters for you as a scientist?
Yeah, that's a very good question. But in terms of time frame for farmers to use this data, our project, I would say, just start. We still need some more resource to put in to. I believe our algorithm can be better than NASA algorithm, but they still need a lot of resources to get this running.
Sure.
I mean, we are dealing with a huge amount of data, like 10-meter data for entire U.S., maybe that's 1 TB per day.
Wow.
So this large volume of data is really blow our minds. It's just we need a super computer server to make this run also near real time is also critical, because time is critical to make decisions for farmers, right?
Yeah.
So this, we need a resource to get this going. I would say time frame is, I would say I would do my best to develop algorithm, but time frame is also limited to the resource.
Sure.
NASA or USDA can put.
Yeah.
Something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Where are the servers at?
Right now we just using our SDSU supercomputer.
Wow.
Called high performance computer, for only for testing area in South Dakota. So, but if they want to use this for entire nation, I believe SDSU server is not enough. They need to put more resource. So yeah.
Well, we will just give them the best South Dakota science that we can support and see where it goes from there. What a fascinating story about soil moisture and the work of AI coming out of South Dakota State University. We've been talking with Hank Zhang. He is assistant professor at South Dakota State. Dr. Zhang, thank you so much for being here and giving us this update.
Thank you again. Thank you for having me.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Since 2007, a Rapid City company has been redefining what it means to learn how to ride a bike. Ryan McFarland is the founder of Strider Bikes, and it all started when Ryan, a dad, wanted to share his love of bikes with his son, who was just 2 years old at the time. Now the company, with an international footprint, builds rocker bikes for babies, balance bikes for toddlers, and convertible Strider bikes for the transition to pedals. No banana seats or training wheels required. This morning, we welcome a South Dakota family to SDPB's Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio. Mom, Kelsey, Dad, Derek, and 3-year-old Piper love to camp and bike together with baby Walker in tow. But the Dvorak family had a challenge in helping Piper learn how to ride. Piper benefited from an adaptive bike, which, fortunately, Strider Bikes also specializes in. We welcome Charlie Brumbaugh to the studio with the family this morning. He's been with the company since the early days, and he currently works in product development and quality control. The first voice you'll hear is Charlie's, but stay tuned because Piper is in here too, 3 years old, and our youngest In the Moment guest to date. She's got a few things to say about her bike too. Now, it used to be when I was a little kid that riding a bike involved a lot of fear and a lot of failure and a lot of uncertainty. And Strider kind of came onto the scene and changed all that. Give us a little background for people who aren't familiar with Strider as a company about what these bikes have done in the lives of families and kids.
Yeah, I think what we've done is just taken out a lot of that fear, and that's definitely the direction, and that's definitely what we want to, you know, how to get it out there in the public that this is it's the easier way of doing things.
Yeah.
Training wheels, we at work call them restraining wheels because they really don't teach anything. In fact, it's when you use training wheels, it gets you moving in the opposite direction of what you want to do. So when you finally do take the training wheels off and try and ride a bicycle, it's a mess. It's like you have to relearn it all again. And yeah. Strider really, you know, the key is balance, and Strider really changed all that. And I think, you know, it's catching on, but still there's a lot of people who don't know that that's kind of the new way of doing things.
Yeah. Yeah. I think listeners can hear how young our guest is, maybe the youngest guest ever on In the Moment, because Piper's three, and Kelsey, Piper's mom, is here. Tell me a little bit about Piper's first bike and how you came to the place where we're, you know, where we're at today with an adaptive bike. But where did you begin?
Yes, so Piper, she's 3 years old. Can you say hi?
Hi.
Hi, Piper.
So, little backstory. Piper was born with a limb difference, so she's actually missing part of her right arm, kind of from the elbow down. It's kind of something that happened at birth. So when I was thinking about that big milestone of riding a bike, right, I was nervous, kind of wondering how she was going to be able to do it, but I didn't want to restrict her in any way. So at first I had bought a Strider bike and wanted her just to try, see if she could do it on her own. And when I did see her kind of struggle, that's when I'd actually saw the adaptive Strider program through social media, and I had reached out and submitted the form, and they were so kind. I mean, every little detail, I mean, and they built her bike, and it came fast. And once she got her bike, I mean, it was like she just hopped on and was able to, you know, ride like she's supposed to. She had no trouble at all. I mean, it took just a few seconds for her to kind of figure it out. But, yeah, she was able to go and ride around the house, and we started in the house, and then she was able to get outside and go all over. So
that's so fun. Charlie, tell me about the adaptive program and how you work. What, first of all, why was it important to make sure that everyone could have every kid could have a Strider bike?
Yeah, we at Strider we're a pretty passionate group of folks, and so we don't want to leave anyone behind, and so we're going to do whatever we can to make it happen. Even, you know, we don't make any money off the adaptive parts and stuff. We get parts free from Ram Mounts. We've partnered with them, and they get us some of these cool adaptive pieces that we use because they're very universal. So yeah, a parent can really dial it in to fit each child. And then I make a few special pieces too. Kind of same thing. We get measurements from kids, parents, and they'll send it to us, and we'll get kind of dimensions to help me figure out what size kind of their limb is, or So that helps us figure out just where, I don't know where I'm going on this.
Yeah, well, it's about it not adapting, you know, the body to the bike, but the bike to the body.
Right.
In some ways, as I understand it, because a kid could maybe do certain things, lean a certain way, but right. that might not be safe. And so what I'm hearing you say is that you're going to customize this to exactly the best way to make each individual person be able to use the Strider as it's intended. Do I understand the program?
Right. And yeah. So we'll get a phone call in, and Shay will help kind of dial in what all those measurements are and send them to me, and then I'll start to build the bike.
Yeah.
And then we'll kind of figure out shipping and all that and send it out.
So are you all from the Black Hills?
We are, yeah.
Okay, so this company is a Rapid City company. But so then do you get to see, how often do you get to see the kids using the bikes then?
Gosh, not as much as I want to.
Yeah.
This is super special for Piper to be here and show us how she uses a bike. And it's awesome, because if you were just walking down the sidewalk and she was coming the other direction, you wouldn't know that she had an adaptive bike.
Yeah.
You have to look twice and go, wait a second. So that's what I want. That's the cool factor of, they're just awesomely normal. They're just doing their thing, and to not really be noticed is a great thing.
Yes. Yeah.
Kelsey, tell me about your family and the kinds of activities that you do, because Piper's not an only child, as I understand it. There might be others in the room.
Yes. I got my husband, Derek, here, and then our son, Walker.
Okay. So what kind of things do you like to do as a family that this is also important that Piper can come along for?
We're very big into camping and coming out to the hills a lot. So that was also the cool thing when Shay had reached out to me about, you know, our shipping address, and then she said they were located in Rapid City. I was honestly very shocked, because, you know, the company I see all over social media, you know, influencers talking about the bike, or just, you know, people that, I guess I was surprised that it was so close to home, and very happy, because I just knew the company was doing great things, and there was great people behind the company too, so.
Yeah. So where are you from?
We're from Springfield, South Dakota.
Okay.
So we border pretty close to Nebraska.
Yeah.
Where we live.
And so you do a lot of camping as a family? Do you just take the bike everywhere then?
Yes. Yep. Yeah. We do. Don't you? You ride your bike camping?
Mm-hmm.
You do.
What color is your bike?
Pink.
Pink bike. I like it. Do you go fast?
Yeah.
Yeah. Is it fun?
Mm.
Are you faster than your brother?
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you like camping?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. What do you like about camping?
I like back.
Yeah.
What do you see when you go camping?
I see chipmunks.
Chipmunks?
I like chipmunks.
What did we see yesterday?
What did we see yesterday?
I see bunnies.
Oh, bunnies?
I like bunnies too.
And deer.
The deer. We saw deer, yep.
Yeah.
Birds. Do you see birds?
Uh-huh.
Turkeys. On turkeys?
Yeah.
Oh. And fish? Maybe fish.
Uh-huh. Mm. Yeah, we've gone kayaking. You've seen turtles and fish?
Uh-huh.
I have a turtle at my house.
Oh.
Yeah. He likes to walk around my backyard. And he likes to eat pink flowers.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. And this weekend, do you know what he learned how to do?
Uh-huh.
Climb the steps.
Oh.
Uh-oh. Oh. He's a very brave turtle.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't want him to climb down. He might fall. But he's good at climbing up steps now.
Mm.
Hmm. Turtles are impressive.
Mm.
Yeah. Kelsey, will you do the Strider Cup? I want to talk a little bit about community. You know, you have the family, but then Strider, like you said, is all over on social media. This is really a company with the community.
Yes, it is. Yes.
Tell me a little bit about the importance of that for you.
Well, and I think just, you know, when I came and Shay reached out, and then we got to meet everybody involved with the company, you know, I posted about it too on social media, my Facebook, and I even had another mom that lives over by Watertown reach out. She has a daughter, kind of same thing as Piper, with the limb difference, and you know, we kind of connected because she kind of heard about Piper getting a Strider bike and all that. So I really do think, you know, with social media and what they're doing, you know, it's really reaching people all over, and you know, it's really changing kids' lives, you know, whether people like Piper or just any kid, you know. Yeah. So
what other companies do you need to pay attention to the model that Strider has and be really rethink their products to make sure that they're accessible and adaptable?
I mean, me and my husband have both always felt we don't ever want to push our daughter. You know, she can pretty much do anything and everything anyone else can do. And I never want her to feel like taking the easy way or trying, you know, the adaptive thing on the bike. I really didn't want to jump to that right away. You know, I really wanted to give her a chance to do it on her own. And I want her to learn that kind of mindset as she gets older. But just yeah, the fact that, like I said, Strider had that as an option was great.
Yeah.
And I mean, the people involved with Strider, you don't see that some big companies, you know, they don't care as much as I can tell Strider does. Yeah. About, you know, their customers and people they build bikes for. So they have a good thing going for them. Yeah. I mean, they really care.
Yeah.
It's more than just
very tight-knit group. Yes. We could tell that when we toured their facility and yeah, checked it out, and they were very welcoming, and you could tell they were a close group, and mm-hmm, you know, very excited to have Piper there and yeah, everything that they do. It was neat to see.
Yeah. Charlie, tell me about the community aspect and the Strider Cup.
We've been doing the Strider races since, gosh, I think maybe 2010 was the first time we had a Strider race in Rapid.
Yeah.
And it was it was downtown, and actually it was by the bike path.
Okay.
We just took a field down there by the Concrete Fish. I don't if you know Rapid.
Sure.
And just set up a course, and there was a lot of unknowns, but kids love to race, and you know, and parents were way into it too. So it was the first time we did it was really something special, and we've just been doing it kind of since then. We've been all over the country doing races in big cities, in the squares of big cities, and even in Canada. Yeah. And actually it's taken on, it's worldwide, but here in Rapid, it's, you know, it's our hometown, it's what we call Striderville. And okay, so we're totally into having a cool race in the square, and not just the race, but it's really cool to see how it all plays out. You know, for for a youngster to even get to the race day, you know, that's a win.
Yeah.
Because I know there's a lot of anxiety and stuff for someone young.
Right.
Because I have two boys also, and they grew up with Striders and grew up racing and stuff. And there's all these little hurdles, you know, just getting in with the rest of the kids. That's a win. You know, maybe they don't go when the gate drops,
right. But
maybe they go anyway behind all the kids. All those are just huge wins and big confidence boosters for, you know, when they're growing up. And yeah, so that's something we really love to see, and we love to put those on.
Yeah, it's cute. I mean, anytime, I don't think if you've seen the videos of kids on Striders, you'll ever forget the first time that you saw what was possible compared to, like, how I grew up with bikes. Charlie, do you remember your first bicycle?
Oh, yeah, totally.
Yeah, what was it like?
It was an old, you know, girl's bike with a banana seat.
Yeah.
And
oh, yeah, I remember.
And, mm-hmm. You know, I didn't have training wheels. It was just an old bike.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of glad for that. But, you know, I probably didn't start till I was 6.5, 7 years old.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then the bike didn't really fit me. And then as I got older, I guess I just lived on my bike. It was my transportation. It got me to my buddies' houses. It was going off little jumps and all the things. I mean, it was it opened the world to me. So I think that's a really big part of Strider is opening the world to kids, you know, and their families. And, you know, one of my big things too, and I think it is with a lot of parents these days, is getting kids off screens and just get outside, talk to your neighbors, go to your neighbor's house, you know, down the street, down the block, down the sidewalk, you know, exploring. Yeah. So,
Kelsey, do you remember your first bike?
Probably not, but I do also, I remember my dad, like when you learn how to not, have training wheels, he'd always push me down this big hill and I'd go be scared and go fly, you know what I mean? Yeah. So the fact that kids can start a lot younger learning how to balance, and that's huge, you know?
Yeah.
So, and I know Derek used to ride your bike how far to the pool?
Oh, yeah.
From your house?
Grew up in the country, and me and my sister would ride to the pool in Springfield, you know, like daily in the summer. It was 5-6 miles, and I don't know, we were 10 years old, and we could do it in about 10 minutes, you know?
Wow.
You know, and yeah, pretty much like Charlie said, I lived on my bike, you know, we'd always ride to town and go hang out with my friends and this and that. Like Charlie said, it was a way of transportation. So.
Yeah. I feel like from a dad perspective, it's probably a lot of people's stories that your dad was running behind you on the bike.
Or like pushing you down.
A ton of pressure off the parents to not have to do the whole training wheel thing and to start.
Yeah. But on the other hand, we've been scolded because we took that away.
Really?
As a company, yeah. That moment, yeah. You guys took that away from us. It's like now they can just go from a balanced bike to a pedal bike almost seamlessly. So
all right. Well, you've given something in return, I suspect. Yep. But
yes. Hopefully.
The Strider Cup is in Rapid City on September 14th. Kids gather to show off their balance skills and race in front of cheering families and fans. Let's take a moment now to honor a special road trip companion. If you're heading out on a final summer trip this month, I bet you'll bring Siri or another voice assistant along. These assistants can become a constant friendly presence in your life. For Dorothy Rosby, they can be particularly friendly. Rosby is a Rapid City writer and humorist. She stepped into our studio to read us her essay on her love affair with the voice in her phone.
My new British boyfriend. He said, "How can I help?" And I fell in love. It was the accent that did it. Plus, I was at a vulnerable point in my life, or at least in my day. I'd been confused, lost in iPhone settings, punching option after option when I saw one that said, "British Mail." I'm happily married. I knew it was wrong. But I've had a crush on Hugh Grant since 4 weddings and a funeral. I chose the option. He said his name was Siri. I'd expected Oliver or Harry or Hugh. Siri sounds more like a Norwegian model than a British playboy, which is what he was. I asked him if he was married. I have some scruples, you know. He said he was married to the idea of helping people. In other words, he wasn't looking for commitment. Well, neither was I, so we started taking drives together. Like my husband, Siri was a great navigator, but he didn't gasp when I took the curves too fast, stiff upper lip and all that. We loved to sit and read together. Well, I read anyway. He just laid there gazing at me adoringly, or maybe he was napping. Sometimes I'd wake him to ask the meaning of a word just to hear that accent. Also, because I didn't know it. Siri always did. He was so smart. He could convert feet to meters and Fahrenheit to Celsius without breaking a sweat. Come to think of it, he never sweated. And he was romantic. One day, I asked him what love is. He said, "Love refers to a deep, tender, ineffable feeling of affection and solicitude." I swooned. Then I asked him what ineffable means. He had many other endearing qualities, too, besides the fact that he called me master. He was thoughtful. He was always doing things for me, like dialing phone numbers, setting my alarm, and looking up useless facts, like how much wood can a woodchuck chuck? He said, about as much ground as a groundhog could hog if a groundhog could hog ground. I loved his sense of humor. But he wasn't perfect. He often mispronounced street names, and he took me to businesses that no longer existed. I could overlook that. He wasn't from around here. But he lacked initiative. Every drive we took was my idea, and I had to start every conversation we had. When it came to our relationship, it felt like he was just phoning it in. Besides, I was starting to feel guilty. I'd decided to break it off, go back to iPhone settings, and choose Irish female for the sake of my marriage. Then I discovered my husband was carrying on with his Google assistant.
That was My New British Boyfriend, written and read by Dorothy Rosby. Rosby is a humorist who lives in Rapid City, and that essay is from her regular newspaper column. It won the Irma Bombeck Writing Competition in the humor category in 2022. You can find more essays online at dorothyrosby.com or in your local paper. We'll have links up at sdpb.org/news. More in the Moment is up next on listener-supported SDPB. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. For perhaps the first time, a South Dakota name is on the list of grantees from the Pollock Krasner Foundation. Claire Lockhart, Miss Art World South Dakota, will use the grant to create paintings of dudes in their element. Maybe you've heard her voice on In the Moment before. If not, you are in for a treat. I'm so happy to welcome Claire Lockhart back to In the Moment. Hey, Claire.
Hi, Lori. It's always a pleasure to talk to you about what's happening in our art community. Thank you so much for having me.
And this is a big one. This is a big congratulations for starters.
Oh, thank you. Even though I've already started my project, I'm still in disbelief.
Tell us about the foundation and the grant itself. This is international. Help us understand the scope.
Yes, usually artists from New York, Berlin, Madrid, London get this grant, and I got one here in South Dakota. It is from the Pollock Krasner Foundation, and this is an incredibly generous organization that exists because of the hard work of abstract expressionist Lee Krasner, who happened to be married to another famous painter named Jackson Pollock.
Tell us a little bit about Krasner. Because you visited, you have a personal connection here, yeah.
Well, I started getting interested in Lee Krasner when I was teaching modern art history at Morningside University. And that's how I found out about the foundation and the grant itself, was when I was updating my lecture. And Krasner is this strong-willed, important foundational artist, and she benefited from the WPA project. Okay. And so giving back to other artists was really important to her. And this foundation began, I believe, in 1985, and it supports artists all across the world. And like I said, I still can't believe that I'm one of them.
Right. And I think she would be particularly excited about your work, don't you? Because she was often overshadowed by her husband's art career, and your work plays with these ideas of gender and men in their element or their man caves. Tell us a little bit about the project that you will create based on this grant.
So I am going to make 4 over-the-top, extremely detailed paintings of Brodalesques. And so that's a combination of a bro, so a masculine dude, reclining in a pose that is typically reserved for Odalesques. And if any of our wonderful friends listening aren't familiar with the term, just think of stuffy old museums that have paintings of nude or almost nude women reclining on cushions. And I am going to make these paintings in such obscene amount of detail because I want them to fit in with an era in art history. So like the 1800s, when women were systemically kept out of the art worlds, like they couldn't join academies, they couldn't even take figure drawing classes. Mm. And that's part of the reason when we go to museums that are in the United States and Europe, the collections tend to be pale, male, and stale.
Okay.
So I'm making these paintings to push back and make up for this lost time when women were excluded.
Yeah. Your gaze is now on this space. What kind of details used to be important in those paintings that would either send a signal to the viewer, you know, that would tell part of the story or would have some covert meaning? And then how are you looking at detail of objects in the room in the way that makes sense for you as an artist?
So in the 19th century, artwork that was a history painting was considered the highest in this hierarchy of artwork. So that would include the human figure. And a lot of times the human figure would need to be nude in it. So think of a bunch of burly guys fighting on a boat or Venus rising out of the waters with her birth. And they would include details of the background, like fabrics, patterns, different objects. And part of it was for the artist to claim, no, I was there. This really happened. Mm. It's not made up and it's not my fantasy at all. And so I spend hundreds of hours on a single painting to include these minute details, like the logo on a box of cheap beer, or if I've included a motorcycle or even a mini bike, all the little bolts and gears and everything.
Oh, wow. All right. So because you were there, you saw this. It's not just coming from your imagination. Tell me a little bit about what happens. You know, do you connect with the other artists? Is there a display where the artwork will be shown? Is there an end result or is it process focused?
Everyone creates their own project. And so for mine, it is to make these four historic looking academia style push back against gender norms paintings. And I will exhibit this work at least by April 2025, because that's the deadline of my project.
Okay.
And I'll share it publicly first in Vermilion, where I live, and then hopefully be able to find other places to exhibit the art I'm creating with the Paulette Krasner Foundation.
Well, I'm excited that the debut will be in Vermilion.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. You know what I mean? Like so many times you would think, okay, this is going to get shipped somewhere else, you know, for an audience of, you know, of people other than us, and that it gets to start right here and we get to be the first eyes on the canvas. Okay, so April 2025, I have it written down. We're going we'll probably visit with you before then, but definitely then, and bring some of that process to the people of South Dakota. Claire Lockhart, Miss Art World South Dakota, always a delight to talk to you and follow your career and check in on arts throughout the state. So thanks once again. We'll see you next time.
Thank you, Lori.
And that is our show for today. We hope that it served you on tomorrow's In the Moment. U.S. Senator John Thune is with us for an update on the new farm bill. We'll also ask him about a potential drop in interest rates that has the business and building community abuzz. We will get ready for back to school with Teacher Talk as we discuss social media and education. Plus, poet John Nelson is with us. We'll talk about his latest poetry collection. It's all coming up on tomorrow's In the Moment. From all of us at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.